To most people, the word filibuster conjures up images of arcane Senate procedure, boring floor speeches, and maybe Ted Cruz reading Green Eggs and Ham on the Senate floor. We'll get back to that one later. If you know what the filibuster even is, you've probably heard about it on the news as that thing that stops the Senate from doing anything. In most media portrayals, the filibuster is what happens when a senator gets up and talks and talks and talks, giving a dramatic speech to stand up for their principles and have a thorough debate on a bill before the House. But it's a little bit more complicated than that. The use of the filibuster has skyrocketed in recent years, and former President Barack Obama recently called it a Jim Crow relic, an obstacle to change. It was used throughout the history of the U.S. to block civil rights legislation, allowing a minority of segregationist senators to block any bill they wanted to. It's influenced what legislation has passed out of Congress for over a century and a half. This is Collective Memory, a podcast on history, collective consciousness, and the forces that drive current events. I'm your host, Nick Gatlin. Today, we're talking about the filibuster. Scholars believe the filibuster, as we understand it, was first created in 1806, when Vice President Aaron Burr suggested that the Senate, quote, get rid of the previous question motion, a Senate rule that would automatically cut off floor debate. Burr and many other senators believed the rule was redundant, and they were looking to clean up the Senate rules to better streamline the legislative process. Once the motion was removed from the Senate rulebook, however, it took decades before anyone realized the consequences of that action. The filibuster, essentially, was created by accident. Before the rule was removed, it was taken for granted that a majority of senators could vote to cut off debate. After it was removed, suddenly it was possible for a senator or a group of senators to indefinitely prolong debate, preventing any bills from being voted on. The first time this happened was in 1837, but the first real filibuster occurred in 1841, when the Democratic minority used their freedom of debate to block a banking bill by Whig Senator Henry Clay. After this filibuster, when the Senate learned of its immense power to block any and all legislation, Clay attempted to change the rules of the Senate to allow a majority of senators to end debate. That attempt failed, as Missouri Senator Thomas Benton criticized Clay for endangering the right to unlimited debate. Still, before the Civil War, use of the filibuster was relatively uncommon. Most senators still believed in majority rule, and if a majority of the chamber wanted to end debate, they did so voluntarily. But as historian Sarah Binder testified to the Senate Committee on Rules and Administration in 2010, that changed dramatically after the war. Quote, by the 1880s, she said, almost every Congress began to experience at least one bout of obstruction. For instance, over civil rights, election law, nominations, even appointment of Senate officers. Even more maddening, when the Senate leadership tried to reinstate the previous question rule, a minority of senators would just filibuster the rule change. This meant that, functionally, the Senate was unable to remove the filibuster because of the filibuster. Every time the rule change was proposed, the entire legislative agenda for the term was at risk because of the threat of constant filibusters. Instead, the Senate instituted changes like unanimous consent agreements, allowing the chamber to conduct business without getting bogged down in procedural objections. Since the Civil War, the filibuster had been used as a tool by a small minority of senators, sometimes a dozen or fewer, to block any legislation they liked. This was obviously untenable, and by the time of Woodrow Wilson's presidency, the time for change was near. In 1915, a war measure and three appropriation bills were killed by a 33-day-long filibuster. In 1917, a proposal to arm merchant ships in the build-up to World War I was defeated by a 23-day filibuster. Even in a national emergency on the brink of war, the Senate could not act. Wilson emphasized this in his public remarks, stating, the, quote, Senate of the United States is the only legislative body in the world which cannot act when its majority is ready for action. A little group of willful men, representing no opinion but their own, have rendered the great government of the United States helpless and contemptible. Finally, overwhelming public opinion and presidential urging caused the Senate to adopt a cloture rule, allowing a two-thirds majority of the Senate to vote to end debate. a filibuster at last could be defeated. But just because a filibuster could be ended didn't mean they often were. A two-thirds majority is incredibly difficult to obtain, especially for legislation that's remotely controversial. In the next century, the filibuster would continue to be used to stonewall legislation, stopping up the Senate until no business could be conducted at all. Much of the public image of the filibuster seems to come from the 1939 film Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where an idealistic freshman senator played by Jimmy Stewart gives a 24-hour, one-man filibuster until he collapses on the ground. The film portrays this as a heroic act against the entrenched establishment, with Mr. Smith using the filibuster to expose corruption in Washington and valiantly stand for his principles.
Order. Order, gentlemen.
Mr. President, I stand guilty as framed because Section 40 is graft. And I was ready to say so. I was ready to tell you that a certain man in my state, a Mr. James Taylor, wanted to put through this dam for his own profit. A man who controls a political machine and controls everything else worth controlling in my state. Yes, and a man even powerful enough to control congressmen. And I saw three of them in his room the day I went up to see him.
And the senator yield.
No, sir, I will not yield.
Many actual senators didn't take the film so well. Majority Leader Alvin Barkley called the film, quote, silly and stupid, saying it made the Senate look like a bunch of crooks. Frank Capra, the film's producer, claimed that several senators had tried to buy up the film to prevent its release. This is all to say that the actual history of the filibuster is a little more complicated than Mr. Smith lets on. In the 1930s, when the film was released, Louisiana Senator Huey Long used the filibuster to block the passage of bills that he thought were too favorable to the rich. He once held the floor for 15 hours, and he passed the time by reading Shakespeare and recipes for pot liquors. His colleagues were not amused. In 1957, segregationist Senator Strom Thurmond filibustered the 1957 Civil Rights Act for 24 hours and 18 minutes, a new record. Thurmond called the bill, quote, cruel and unusual punishment. Senator William Noland replied that the day-long speech was cruel and unusual punishment to his colleagues. 7 years later, Senator Robert Byrd conducted a 14-hour filibuster of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. For only the second time since 1927, the Senate mustered over 67 votes to invoke cloture, cutting off debate and allowing the bill to pass. Before this point, the filibuster had been a favorite weapon of Southern segregationists, allowing them to block any and all civil rights legislation that came through the Senate. It was only in 1964 that political will and public opinion aligned to finally defeat the segregationists. Southerners had used a platoon system of filibustering that would allow 3 6-member teams to take turns on the floor, giving them all time to rest in between speeches and ensuring no bills could come to a vote. In 1975, the Senate finally amended the rules to allow 60 senators, or 3/5 of the chamber, to invoke cloture. This helped the problem somewhat, but still meant that a minority of 41 senators could block any legislation favored by 59 of their colleagues. Minority rule was still the tradition of the Senate.
And I would go for another 12 hours to try to break Strom Thurmond's record, but I've discovered that there are some limits to filibustering, and I'm going to have to go take care of one of those in a few minutes here. But I do appreciate the Senate's forbearance in this, and I hope that if there are some on the other side of the aisle who have been listening and feel that they may agree on some of these issues, that if they will use their ability to impact the president's decision.
From 1917 to 1970, there were fewer than 60 cloture motions in the Senate. From 1970 to 2000, cloture motions increased dramatically at around 17 per year. Between 2000 and 2018, the number of cloture motions per year increased to an average of 53, with the trend going up. The 115th Congress, which was in session from 2017 to 2018, had 168 cloture votes and only passed 52 pieces of legislation in a floor vote in their entire two-year term. The Senate, especially in recent years, has become entirely dysfunctional. Ted Cruz famously read Green Eggs and Ham on the Senate floor to signal his disapproval of Obamacare. And though he wasn't blocking a specific piece of legislation, his overnight 21-hour speech clearly evoked the filibuster tradition.
And I love this story, and so I'm going to read it to you. Sam I Am. That Sam I Am, that Sam I Am. I do not like that Sam I Am. Do you like green eggs and ham? I do not like them, Sam I Am. I do not like green eggs and ham. Would you like them here or there? I would not like them here or there. I would not like them anywhere. I do not like green eggs and ham. I do not like them, Sam I Am.
Where the filibuster was previously used by mainly Southerners to block civil rights legislation, it has become a tool to block almost all legislation from passing through the Senate. The filibuster now more than ever allows a minority of senators to block legislation supported by a majority of their colleagues or a majority of the country. As it stands today, the 21 least populous states, representing two senators each and therefore past the 41 senators needed to sustain a filibuster, represent 11% of the U.S. population. If you take the 21 least populous states represented by Republicans, they represent less than 25% of the population, and taking the 21 least populous Democratic states, that increases to 46% of the population. Any way you look at it, the filibuster can block policies supported by the vast majority of the country simply due to the opposition of as little as 11% of Americans. Now, obviously, there are other obstacles to these measures being passed, and political coalitions are tenuous. But the filibuster, or the threat of one, often stops even the most popular policies from passing a floor vote, because a small minority of senators are able to hold up the proceedings indefinitely. A report from the Center for American Progress detailed all the bills that likely would have become law if not for the filibuster, including the 2010 Disclosure Act, meant to strengthen campaign donation disclosure requirements, and the DREAM Act, creating a legal path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants who entered the U.S. before their 16th birthday. All of these bills had enough votes to pass the Senate, but could not overcome the 60-vote supermajority needed to defeat a filibuster. Because any senator can invoke a filibuster at any time for any bill that passes through the Senate, in practice, needs 60 votes to pass. The Brennan Center for Justice, in a report on abuse of the filibuster, notes that the Constitution only includes 7 distinct requirements for a supermajority vote, including impeachment and overriding a presidential veto. Originally, the Senate rules were functionally identical to the House of Representatives, allowing debate to be cut off by a majority vote. Every indication we can gather from the Constitution and the Founders' intentions were that the Senate was meant to operate by majority rule. At former Congressman and civil rights icon John Lewis's funeral, former President Barack Obama signaled his support for issues that Lewis had fought for in his life, including automatic voter registration, Puerto Rico and D.C. statehood, an end to partisan gerrymandering, and an Election Day federal holiday. After he listed these goals, Obama ended, quote, "And if all this takes eliminating the filibuster, another Jim Crow relic, in order to secure the God-given rights of every American, then that's what we should do," unquote. On its face, it seems absurd that 11% of the population's senators could block the will of the other 89%. The filibuster is, by its very nature, counter-majoritarian and anti-democratic. Its long history is riddled with segregationists and populists using its power to block even basic civil rights legislation. If America is truly a democracy, its legislature should be responsive to the majority of voters. And since its creation, the filibuster has stood opposed to this basic principle. Maybe in due time, the filibuster, like other counter-majoritarian relics of our past, will fall to the winds of change. This has been Collective Memory, a production of the PSU Pacific Sentinel. Special thanks to the U.S. Senate, the Brennan Center for Justice, New Hampshire Public Radio, Politico, PBS, the University of Minnesota Law School, the Brookings Institution, the Center for American Progress, the National Constitution Center, the Congress of Racial Equality, Duke University Law School, NPR, PBS NewsHour, Pew Research, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and the Associated Press for the research for this episode. Thanks for listening.